week's episode of the Data Protection Made Easy podcast with myself, Jasmine Harrison, and I'm joined by Joe Kirk, Phil Brining, and Katerina Santos. Hello, all of
Hello.
You.
Hello.
Hello.
This week's session was an international transfers part two. You know, we decided that there was a need for a second one on our last session, and it was challenging, and I think it kind of represented the difficulties faced with international transfers in general, to be honest, because we ran through some scenarios which, even if they weren't the most complicated, you know, it can be difficult to digest. We also spoke about Meta and its privacy policy and, you know, how it transfers data amongst its, you know, entities and also with third parties. So that was an interesting conversation. But yes, I'll throw the baton. What were your highlights?
My highlight was probably where we did the 15-20 minute news piece at the start. I know that's probably not the aim of the session, because it
would have been a great GDPR radio.
Yeah, it really would have done it. We've timed that quite poorly, but you know, we had a 50-50 chance and got it wrong, but we'll probably explore what we spoke about in further detail next week. But yeah, we touched on a news piece about the DWP getting given powers to access bank accounts in relation to fraud, and obviously this comes off the back of a proposed change in the DPDI bill that was scrapped in June, I believe it was. And then, yes, after about 20-odd minutes, we did finally move into international transfers, didn't we? And I did quite actually enjoy the conversation, trying to wrap my head around the complexities of Meta and intergroup international transfers. So I think that's something to listen out for in the session.
Absolutely. What was your favourite part, Katerina?
So I think my favorite part, aside from the news that Joe already talked about, I think the scenarios were really interesting, to be honest. I think the fact that we could go across several realities, different scenarios that actually we came across daily basis, and there are so many details that we as a controller or a processor we need to be aware of. So it was really interesting to understand what will be what is the ICO position on in this regard, and providing some guidance and be able to discuss these several scenarios.
Yeah, I think for me, I quite enjoyed the debate around the scenarios. You know, just highlighting again the complexities and potential different interpretations in the EU and the UK, and different people's interpretations. You know, and you know, that's what I think the podcast's about, really, isn't it? It's trying to stimulate debate and thought process, trying to get people to you know, it's a real shame we didn't get onto the derogations piece. I wanted to talk those through, because I think everyone would have had a different opinion as to, you know, is that a good example of the use of that derogation? Would it stand up? And you know, and the podcast's good at getting you to come across things you don't necessarily come across in your job as a DPO in a whatever you work in. So yeah, I mean, all this kind of debate and the discussion is, I think it's all good stuff.
Yeah, I enjoyed, I think the podcast is obviously is also useful for common questions and issues that people face, you know, in applying data protection law. And I think a common one is what, you know, whose responsibilities are at play when you've got controllers and processors and sub-processors and sub-sub-processors. Where do you draw the line, and how do you approach that, and how can you be confident that, you know, your organization isn't at risk, or it, you know, if it has to accept the risk as well. So there was some really interesting conversation within that. I think, you know, international transfers is probably one of the more complex areas of data protection law, and it can be, there's so much to unpack within that, that we tried, you know, we touched on a few important concepts. So we hope you enjoyed the session anyway, and we will be back next week for a GDPR radio, and yeah, hopefully see you then.
Chaos.
Yeah, my week's been really busy. I can't actually remember what I've been doing, but I've
done lots and lots of bits. But what's been really nice, my highlight of the week has been chatting to the consultants. So ring me up, somebody rang me up last night at about 6 o'clock, was it? Looking at nobody in particular. No, half past five. said, I see you're still Teams is on green, so can we talk through this potential breach? An actual breach. And that's been really nice, actually, because I've had lots of people ringing me up saying, what about this and what about that, you know, across cyber and the, and that good. It makes me feel wanted. Makes me feel like I've got a contribution to make. So that's been my highlight of the week, but it's been a very busy week. Moving on.
The intersection can get like that sometimes. Yeah, to be honest, my memory is always short term on these when a math hammer week's been. So I'll pass the baton to you, Katerina and Joe.
Go on, Joe, if you want to start. Be my guess.
My week has been I don't know, really. I can't remember what I've been doing. I've been still doing this DPA project with Phil on dark web monitoring, and that's taken up quite a lot of my time and my brain power as well. And I've also been doing some work on some exemptions, following on the conversation we had last Friday about exemptions relating to information rights requests. And that's been, I think, I've been getting a lot of work. I don't know if it's on purpose or what, but a lot of work that's taken up a lot of brain power. And I just end up just sitting and just thinking a lot, and then ringing Phil and asking for his opinion, see if I'm on the right line. But
that makes me feel wanted, Joe. And,
well, you're always wanted. I just never know if you've got time. But yeah, I'll always give you a ring, Phil, if I need a second opinion, or save it for this, because I think it's always good to share what we come across. But my week's been all right, Jasmine.
Good.
Kate.
Yeah. To be honest, mine was a little bit of a chaos. I had a lot of ropers meetings, a lot of clients audit reports to deliver, because we are in the end of the month, so a lot of monitoring reports to deliver. And me and Kane are preparing a cookie audit that is coming up in the next few weeks, so it's being exciting to will be my first cookie audit. So Phil will be wanted as well, because I will ask you for, obviously, your tips and advice on those, and Joe as well, because you are the cookie expert now.
I thought I got away from it.
Like, no, yes, never.
Yeah, go bother Phil. My time's too precious. Glad to help you.
So the dark web monitoring has been really interesting, because we've got it right into the European case law, and the go right back to the Google v the AEPD and Gonzalez, was it? I think it was.
Yeah.
And then looking at the opinion again of the European Data Protection Board and Working Party 29 of the control and processor. It's been really interesting, because we've probably changed slightly our view of all the various relationships between the various parties, haven't we, Joe? So
yeah.
But of course, we're trying to write a data protection impact assessment on this. So we're wanting to properly and thoroughly justify our stance, and also look at the counter arguments. You know, well, you could be a processor, you could be a controller. You know, these things lent to themselves to you being more of a processor, these things to more being a controller. And that's been really quite fun, hasn't it, to put those kind of legal constructive arguments together.
Yeah, I'm not sure you describe it as fun, but
take a lot of work and research, though. It's actually quite good to do, because I think you probably don't, but I forgot all about this kind of Google v Spain, you know, back in 2013. I'd forgotten it existed.
I was in year 9, Phil, when that happened, so I was this is the first time it's known to me.
Right. Anyway.
Sorry, don't want to make you feel old.
No further comments.
No, no comments at all.
Anyway, the news this week, moving swiftly on. I found a couple of pieces. I'm not sure if you've, you know, seen a lot that's been going on, but it seems like it's picking up a little bit, because I think we had a bit of a dry spell. I don't know if you saw about the Department for Work and Pensions spying powers.
Yeah.
Inverted commas, to be coming, to be making a reappearance under the Fraud, Error and Debt Bill. So it was announced, I believe, this week, that the government is going to introduce legislation into this parliamentary session to address benefit fraud. So it will be looking to tackle fraud in the social security system, giving DWP more powers to catch fraudsters and prevent individuals from getting into debt while protecting the most vulnerable, to ensure support goes to those who need it most. And Keir Starmer has promised to leave no stone unturned. as the government works to rebuild the public services. So what are your thoughts on that? You know, we there were elements of the Data Protection and Digital Information Bill that we thought, you know, we might have escaped, I suppose, or gone past, and this has come back. And, you know, in the first instance, there was a lot of, unsettlement, I suppose. Is that the right word? I don't know if I said that the right way, but people were unsettled by it, you know, and the access and the rights that would be granted to the Department for Work and Pensions, and now it's making a reappearance.
Agree. Yeah, I think that was one of the probably one of the key things of the DPDI bill that was probably alarming to me, was the fact that they were going to give DWP access to people's bank accounts. I mean, what's the argument for, like, the lawful grounds of processing, probably legitimate interest, you know, in order to kind of, you know, prevent fraud, because it's, you know, it's quite a serious thing. But, you know, is accessing people's bank accounts the right or wrong, the right thing to do? I mean, probably not on the, well, you know, on the face of it, but
apparently they won't have direct access to people's bank accounts, but they can request information from banks, or not even request, you know, I suppose demand information from banks. Banks will be required to provide this information upon request. I mean, it includes things like search and seizure powers, and I don't really know on what basis they will request this information if they don't have, you know, that initial suspicion or reason for, you know, for investigating. So it doesn't really add up to me at this moment in time. I don't think, for me, there's enough information to understand the logistics of it and how it will look, but maybe someone else can shed some further light on that.
It really isn't it. I think for the fraud prevention, I mean, it's clear, like, public interest could be one of the lawful basic applicable here, but without having any suspicion or anything about that, it's just, how can you try to prevent something if you don't have, like, any idea if actually is going on, or any suspicions of what is going on, you know? So, it's weird.
Yeah, it's I think there's a lot of room for error as well, which is a big concern, you know, if people are being, misidentified as suspected fraudsters. You know, there's very careful criteria and steps that need to be laid out to make sure that any risk is minimized, but I think it will still occur regardless, and that will probably cause a lot of public upset, you know, regardless of the good it might bring and whatnot. I think,
well, I think the big issue here, right, is that DWP have an access to people's bank accounts, and if someone was wrongly identified for fraud,
discrimination is risk.
Yes, but I mean, like, you know, if DWP observe and then request to observe someone's bank accounts, right, and are given that access, I think the biggest issue here is around purpose limitation. What if they find something in there that's not linked to fraud? I don't know. Is it fraud regarding pensions or just payments from organisations? I'm not sure. But what if they find in there other stuff around, you know, other illegal activities that could lead to, you know, criminal investigations aside from fraud? I mean, I think that's probably maybe the biggest risk here. And I mean, you could probably argue that it's not similar but as important, but I guess that's not the purpose of DWP being given access, is it, to people's bank accounts? So I think they've got to be a little bit careful here. I think there is it's quite risky processing, I think.
Yeah, I think from what Lawrence has said in the chat here, it you know, there's potential that it might go the opposite way. He said one of the chilling things I've read is the public domain of being described as the pre-crime space. Philip Dick would have a field day with that phrase for fans of the Minority Report. Perhaps they could have AI predicting fraud. That's possible.
Based on what, though? Based on, like, activities within a bank account? I mean, that opens up another avenue for it just doesn't, I don't know. Using AI to predict fraud just seems a little bit invasive. You know, how would you feel about AI that, you know, isn't 100% at the moment having assumptions about you? I mean, it's profiling, isn't it? It's
making an automated means, probably, as well.
Which is, you know, Michael, you got your hand up. Do you want to chime in?
I mean, it's really good points, because I mean, we're still trying to come to grips with it, really. And there's been so many use cases of the wrong data being used, the wrong assumptions with things. I think there was a case, I can't quote it, but there was one, I think, where a police force was sent to the wrong place based on bad data. And that's the last thing you want to do with these sort of things, right? Well, I'd imagine, yeah, like you said, like maybe they raid like 200 people's homes in one day and they go to the wrong address, or there's no substantial crime, so all reason to do it, and they've caused a lot of property damage, trauma for people, and potentially you're letting everyone, if maybe they go to the house three doors down, so you're letting everybody know that this crime's happening, so that you're giving time for the criminals to get away. So it's not practical, is it, really, if they haven't got it completely sussed out? And with all these FOI requests and stuff for things released out, would you trust the police with that sort of data? Would you, do you think they would use it properly? Would they use the right algorithm, or they just search on Google for the cheapest software download and try and use that as the solution?
Good points.
Thank you. Lawrence has also said in the chat, what does everyone have to hide? I mean, I think when, so I'm not, you know, I'm not claiming any benefits off the top of my head anyway. And, you know, when I initially read this, it's a gut feeling more than anything, you know, of concern and invasion, really. There are benefits to it, you know, it will hopefully improve the economy in ways by saving money, protecting public services, etc. But there is also that risk there, and I think with certain track records, you know, that it's likely, you know, that it will cause some damaging effects to certain people. So that's, I think that's where the concern comes from in this instance anyway. And it also scuffle some of my future plans. To be fair, it's coming up towards 10 too, so I just wanted to raise, because it segues into the session a little bit as well, I don't know if anybody's seen going around on social media this week a post that people have been resharing. So it's specifically on Instagram that I've seen it, and I screenshotted it yesterday. And at that moment, like yesterday afternoon, probably like 4 o'clock or something, maybe before, 750,000 people had reshared this post. So it reads, "Goodbye, Meta AI. Please note, an attorney has advised us to put this on. Failure to do so may result in legal consequences. As Meta is now a public entity, all members must post a similar statement. If you do not post at least once, it will be assumed you are okay with them using your information and photos. I do not give Meta or anyone else permission to use any of my personal data, profile information, or photos." Yeah, so this took me back to, you know, well, no disrespect to anyone if they are offended by this, but you know when you get like your grandparents or your parents on Facebook who are resharing things like
a free holiday,
100%, yeah.
Just all sorts,
and it's clearly
rubbish,
a fake account. Yeah.
If you share this, yeah, or if you share this, you will be granted 3 wishes. Stupid things like that. Do you know what I mean? Like, it all, you see all sorts. This reminds me of that, but at the same time, because it makes no sense, you know, Meta isn't a public entity. Resharing a post on your Instagram story, I don't think it's going to change anything in relation to, you know, how Meta handle your data. There are, you know, methods for that, but at the same time, it's positive that, you know, people are having an awareness of the, you know, personal data as a concept as well. And their rights with regard to that.
I think what that highlights actually is there's a lot of people that if they're aware of it, they wouldn't be happy with actually what organizations are doing with their personal data in relation to trading AI. They're probably just not aware that their data is currently being used. Exactly. I think obviously Instagram is something that our generation anyway uses all the time, right? We're always on Instagram. So it's no surprise that people are saying, I don't want it to happen. I think the alarming thing is that they probably don't realize that it is actually happening without, like, with many organizations, and they don't even know it. And it's just like, I've sat on here before, and I said that there's so many people in, like, you know, outside of the world of data protection that aren't actually aware of what is going on and their rights and the consequences of what's going to, like, their data. And they kind of just see it as a very kind of tick box exercise, boring thing, like, oh yeah, we don't have to worry about data protection. But, you know, I think this just raises the point that there's people out there that, you know, they do care about their privacy and they don't want their personal data to be used for AI purposes, but they're just not aware. And if you're not aware, you can't do anything about it, can you? So it's just like, I don't really know where I'm going with this, but I just think that what's happening with AI and the kind of use of personal data is just wrong. And if people were aware of it, that many people probably wouldn't be happy with it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, I think it's quite alarming, isn't it, that these issues are here and people just don't know. Like LinkedIn, for example, like you wouldn't know unless you're chronically on there that these things are happening and what that would mean to you. In actual fact, probably most people have at least a LinkedIn account. They might not use it often, but their data is being harvested without them being aware. And
no,
if you're not aware of it, you can't raise an issue about it. You can't like ask for it to be stopped.
Lawrence's point's interesting, isn't it? You know, is the UK potentially moving towards a more of a US version and interpretation of privacy and away from the EU version? It's quite interesting to think that one through, isn't it?
It feels like it at times, but yeah, I suppose with especially when the recent bill that the previous bill, the DPDI bill, when that was coming into play, I think, you know, the weakening of privacy laws and so on at that point, it did seem like we were trying to cozy up to the US a little bit more. I think there are still elements of that and definitely areas for reform if we are to keep or to improve on our, you know, data protection stance, especially with regard to the ICO. But yeah, it's something to.
It's interesting though, because we've been as a country, we've been quite at the forefront, or initially at the forefront of the development of some of the data protection kind of thoughts and theories, with the Younger report, you know, back in the '70s, and the other reports in the '70s, where Lindop. So there's 10 principles in the Younger report, and you know, most of them appear in fact, I think all of them, apart from one, probably appears in the current version of the GDPR, and most of them were in the 98 Act. So, you know, we've helped form and shape thinking, I think, as a country on data protection, and to kind of leave that behind and tear it up and move away from it would be a real shame, I think.
Agree.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, no, go on. I could get into this, but it's 53 and we're not really. Yeah.
I wish it was a GDPR radio.
I know.
Yeah.
I could have elaborated a lot further, but let's. Jasmine, would you like to take the lead?
Sure. Well, keeping on the topic of Meta, it's actually quite relevant because looking at, you know, our notes from the first session, there was a part that we didn't touch on, and it was around Meta's privacy policy and the fact that they share data with other Meta companies. So, for example, Facebook and Instagram, or Facebook and WhatsApp, etc.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that it's probably worth looking into that a little bit. So the privacy policy states that we are part of the Meta companies that provide Meta company products. Meta company products include all the Meta products covered by this policy, plus other products such as WhatsApp, Novi, and more. We share the information we collect, infrastructure, systems, and technology with the other Meta companies, learn more about how we transfer information to other countries. We also process information that we receive about you from other Meta companies according to their terms and policies and as permitted by applicable laws. We'll get to the point. In some cases,
no wonder we get snoring.
In some cases, Meta acts as a service provider for other Meta companies. We act on their behalf and in accordance with their instructions and terms. Meta products share information with other Meta companies to promote safety, security, and integrity, and comply with applicable laws, to personalise offers, ads, and other sponsored or commercial content, to develop and provide features and integrations, to understand how people use and interact with Meta company products.
Does it give any any idea of the lawful basis for processing?
You know, it's funny you say that, because the policy itself is just a minefield. So let me share my screen.
Don't, no.
No, just quickly. Just so you can understand.
Phil's so dying to do his scenarios.
Yeah.
No, I want to do my quiz.
Can you see my screen?
It's black.
It's blank
moment.
Now.
Let me just.
Yeah, we can see now.
Okay.
So why am I mentioning whether it asks about Love Faith of posting? Because one of the things that Joe and I have looked on this dark web is where a search engine is posting special category data, and the European Data Protection Board have issued an opinion on how to apply the Google v. ADPD and Gonzalez ruling, which is quite interesting. Mm-hmm. Because they say in that ruling that a search engine only has to justify special category data when it is responding to a subject access request. And that was really quite odd, I thought. But anyway, carry on. I just wondered what they're saying in here.
So I just wanted to share my screen because there are so many links to like further information that it is just so hard to follow. But the, you know, they state here the lawful basis that they rely on. Performance of a contract, I noted they use that for advertising, for personalized ads. So that hasn't changed, you know, since...
What about special category data? Anything on special category data?
There was a table somewhere.
Yeah.
It's just so hard to...
It's really confusing. Really confusing.
I was having a look at Microsoft Security the week before last, and that, again, I spent 2 hours just following trails around.
You need a few days to get through this. Yeah.
Good old transparent privacy information.
Yeah. I know.
And I get it. You know, they're a massive organisation that probably want to answer all questions without having to, you know, answer them on a one-to-one basis. But it's just difficult. Yeah. You've got videos that were noted further off. I'm not even going to look there yet. I think this one.
I bet it's not as good as Legos. Consent.
Yeah, processing information with special protections that you provide. So this is why and how. So that we can share it with those you choose to provide and personalise and improve our products to undertake analytics. We'll collect, store, publish and apply automated or sometimes manual processing for these purposes. This is under the basis of consent. So there's different ones, at, you know, at different parts. I could control
It is actually quite nice and comprehensive, isn't it?
Yeah, it is very comprehensive. Like, they give you an overview of, you know, the highlights here. So this is like an overview of the section, and then you can find further information, but then it just... You end up in a proper rabbit hole.
Too much links, and you go just
I found it interesting though. So on the topic of international transfers, they have a report, an annual report on government requests for information.
Yeah.
So US requests. So since 2013, they've had. Hold on, I don't think that's the whole. Oh, that's since July. I think that it was like 330,000 requests or something, and then there was about 500,000 accounts that this included. So it could, you know, I suppose people could have multiple accounts. But I just found it really interesting. I was looking through it, trying to find how many of these they actually provided information for. I didn't quite get to that yet. You know, under Pfizer, for example. But
is this globally? Is it from like requests from governments globally?
I think U.S.
Right, that's a lot, isn't it? 300,000 in
since
2013, 11 years. That's still a lot.
Up to 23. Yeah, but I thought it was interesting. It's probably you know, something to just have a little look through in your spare time.
Okay, well then I've got a question here that. For international transfers that somewhat relates to this, right? So say you are a UK organization and you're sending data to Meta in a data center in the UK, but that data, although unlikely, could be shared back to the US should an American intelligence agency request that information under section 702 of the Pfizer. Are you required to implement additional safeguards, or should you do it as kind of like a err on the side of caution, kind of best practice sort of thing, or do you just wait for it to happen and do it if it occurs, and in the meantime just you don't need to because it's stored in the UK?
So if upon receiving a request, do you mean should they
so I'm saying like in when you say we're going to use Meta as a company and you know that it could go to the US but it might not, do you leave it until it occurs? Do you implement SECs on like the on the side of caution? Or...
Wouldn't you say that because Meta relies on the data protection data privacy framework?
Okay, so then all right, well then take that, take it out from an organisation that's not covered by that. Sorry, I'm just trying to be a pain.
Me and Kate were talking, but I will get back to this because it's a good question. Yeah. But me and Kate were talking earlier about Meta and the UK, well, the UK bridge to the data privacy framework, and it didn't really specify that they'd, you know, join that elements of it.
I think that the key thing, Joe, I would have said is depend on the relationship between the UK entity and the US entity. So if the UK entity is in distinctly different legal entity from the US entity and they're acting as a processor, it's their responsibility to make sure that onward transfer is covered off with one of the legal gateways, isn't it? That doesn't mean to say you haven't got a responsibility to check it, but you know, that's what the ICO says. I think the European Data Protection Board has a different view on it, but the ICO says if they're part of the same entity, it's not international transfer, and if they're different entities, it's up to them if they're a processor to deal with that, isn't it?
Mm.
I'm not trying to sit on the fence or fudge it, but I don't think there's a straightforward answer to that question. Mm-hmm. I know where you're going with it. You know, we've got a UK, we transferred to a mailing house in the UK, and then they shunt it onto the US, you know, either as a one-off exercise or, you know, and maybe they would rely on a derogation that we're going to talk about hopefully today to do that. But you know, I think we'd have to look again at some scenarios. And maybe they've come up in the quiz discussion that we're going to have.
Are we going to do that?
If we've got time, we'll do the quiz discussion.
That was a terrible, I'm not sure the name of it, but a bad joke. Quiz discussion.
Yeah. yeah, I think it's a bit difficult actually. I'm trying to navigate this privacy policy because I wanted to talk about the safeguard mechanisms that they've got in place.
I confirm
this
now
is Facebook, data... not Meta's privacy policy, but
I confirm now. So the data privacy framework, they do not have the UK extension one, the US, the Swiss one, but the UK extension, they have no certification on that.
Yeah,
Meta. Yeah.
I saw earlier that they have standard contractual clauses in place, and then the addendum, the international data transfers addendum, or just the IDT agreement.
Okay.
Yeah. And then with some supplementary measures as well, but I'd like to see what those are.
Mm-hmm.
Have they got binding corporate rules at Meta?
No. That's
You're coming to the framework now. They've got the EU-US privacy framework and the Swiss-US privacy framework. That's what they've got.
Yeah, they don't have the UK extension.
They don't have compliant cookies either because it's not letting me reject them.
Is there a place where you can find out who has binding corporate rules? Is there like a database anywhere that...
There is a list, yeah.
A list of companies that have it.
Is it a public list?
Yeah.
Mm. There's not many, is there, though, I don't think.
It's about
really
200.
Okay. That's not a lot, though, is it, really, in the grand scheme of things?
No.
But that's good to know, though, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
I'll try and find it.
Oh, here we are.
Oh, so it was global requests, sorry, Joe. Global requests for user data is 301,000 and a half, basically. And then 528,000 user accounts requested. But I'll put a link into the chart in case anyone wants to look into it.
Yeah, I've put a link into it. Approved binding corporate rules. The European Data Protection Boards.
Do you want to go through some of your scenarios, Phil?
No, I don't know.
I do.
They're not my scenarios, okay? So I said last time, full disclosure, we were preparing for the session and we said we would have a look at the ICO's guidance. And this is the ICO's guidance. They've got these 10 scenarios that they talk through. Thank you. So there's the link to it. You know, so it's not a quiz because the answers are there. You know, if I can get my screen to move on. So their first scenario. This is dead simple stuff, I think. You know, an Australian retailer. I won't read it out, but you can read it. So you've got consumers. You know, and
maybe read it for the listeners.
Oh, it's a good question. Good point. Yes, an Australian retailer advertises and sells shoes to people in the UK via its website. Its processing of their data is governed by the UK GDPR. It uses an Australian processor to run its website and a UK logistics company to deliver the shoes. So I've kind of kind of jotted that down as consumers send data to a shoe company. They send data to a processor. They send data to a logistics company. So the ICO is saying, yeah, that there is a restricted, it's probably obvious, this, you know, there is a restricted transfer from the Australian shoe company to its Australian processor. even if the data flows directly from the UK customers. I think we came across this with one of our customers a few months ago, where they were transferring data from the UK direct to a processor, but via a German company. And I think the ICO's guidance was follow the contracts. And we said, no, surely you've got to follow the data, see where the data's going. Mm-hmm. So the transfer of the data has been initiated and agreed by the Australian company, and it's processing that data is going by the UK GDPR. That's what the ICO's scenario is, and there's no restricted transfer to the UK logistics company as it's in the UK. I don't know if you want to kind of talk through any of these. I mean, there are some that are a little bit more complicated. But I mean, that seems pretty straightforward, doesn't it? You know, you've got an Australian company, selling via its website, caught by the UK GDPR. It uses an Australian processor and a UK logistics company. So the data goes from the UK consumer to the shoe company to the processor. Seem straightforward enough, does it?
Yeah, I think what might confuse people is, I think just to make sure I'm on the same page, I don't know why it stumped me a little bit, but a transfer from Australia to Australia, but because you're processing personal data of those in the UK, is considered to be a restricted transfer, even though it's going from Australia to Australia. That's what's happening here, right? Mm. Yeah. But then the transfer from Australia to the UK of the personal data of those in the UK
is not because
the personal data belongs to the UK as opposed to those in Australia.
Yeah. And because the shoe company's got an Australian processor, Australian shoe company has got the responsibility of getting the processor into appropriate contract, appropriate mechanisms. So it seems that one I read through, yeah, that seems, I can get my head around that. It seems quite straightforward. Don't know if anybody's got anyone's falling asleep, I think. Scenario two, a UK healthcare company enters into agreement with a UK processor for data analytics services on its patient data. The analytics is carried out by a sub-processor located outside the UK. The data flows directly from the UK company to the overseas sub-processor. Again, this is the exact scenario we came across with one of our customers. So controller goes to a processor, goes to a sub-processor, and the sub-processor is outside the UK. Imagine that. I'm looking at it, they're quite hard to the UK healthcare company does not need to comply with the transfer rules of the transfer between the UK processor and its sub-processor. Again, we just clarifying, aren't we, that it's these different distinct legal entities, and that it's you got to work through.
Yeah, I think that might be something that can cause confusion at times, you know, because ultimately the controller is responsible. But then what role should they play if they're aware of a sub-processor that's based in a country that doesn't have adequate protections? If the transfer takes place between the processor and sub-processor, is it even morally, just on a moral or ethical level, is that right?
This is where due diligence is so important, right? Yeah. So when you're carrying out your due diligence and you're looking at your processes, you should be looking at the sub-process that they use and where the data will end up eventually. So I think that's why
it's not easy in practice. In practice, I've been chasing down some processes, accounting firms as well, the ones who I know are acting as a processor for somebody, and I'm asking about where the data is being transferred to, and I'm not getting any response whatsoever. It's a UK company, which is really irritating and frustrating. Mm-hmm. So it's all right having this stuff, this is what you got to do, but you try getting information out of another organization and they're just blank you.
Well, that's where if you're waiting in that scenario and it's kind of like it's stopping you from doing your duties as an organization in terms of the service you provide, that's probably then you just have to take a bit of a practical standpoint and say, look, we're not getting any sort of information here. We need to do this, but we want to know. You've got to assess the risk, haven't you, and see if you can proceed and kind of monitor it until you know. And I don't want to say that you should do that, but what else can you do as an organization? Should you sit and wait?
You can always accept the risk, can you? Yeah, there's nothing.
I think that's what you have to do, yeah?
Yeah.
Just moving on. Somehow ended up at the very top of the chat, so I've not seen if there's any chat going on, but there isn't, as it happens.
What would you say in a situation then where, you do accept the risk and the ICO, there's an issue and the ICO come knocking? Would you say that the ICO would appreciate that you have considered it and that would help, you know, your situation or your case? Mm-hmm. Or do you think that they'd say, I suppose it depends on the context, doesn't it, really? If it's a high risk and you choose to accept it, then
exactly.
I think they'd say, I don't think they'd be forgiving at all. I think they'd say, you know, all right, fine, you've accepted the risk. Right, here's a fine.
Yeah. Hey, hang on, the ICO don't give out fines, not under the GDPR anyway. You'll have a reprimand is what you'll have.
That'll be everyone else in this call accepting risks from now on.
Yeah, disclaimer, I am not saying to do that.
I don't know if this is if you want me to move on, I will gladly move on. I mean, in terms of like do something else and talk about something else, but this is another scenario, and it's all in the UK, in the ICO's guidance. UK Controller has two processes. The first is located in the UK and provides general HR services, and the other is located in Mexico and provides HR analytics. The UK Controller has a separate contract with each processor, so two contracts with each processor. ICO says UK Controller instructs UK processor to send certain data files to its Mexican processor. So it's telling the processor to send the data to Mexico. You know, who's responsible for getting the Mexican side on board? Again, I think it's probably obvious the restrict transfer between the UK Controller and the Mexican processor because the UK processor has been instructed to do it. So again, if you're kind of drafting up contracts and you're making an instruction, you transfer this data here overseas, then the process then not responsible according to this to then get the contract in the mechanism in place.
Seems quite
straightforward, yeah.
I think there's certain areas of data protection law, international transfers being one, where when it gets complicated, my brain just shuts down and can't process anything, like, because it can get so complicated. And I think that when it's paired with, you know, trying to identify relationships and data flows despite, you know, where those organizations are based, and then adding that next level of complexity, it can be so difficult at times. I'm assuming that's where your scenarios are going to gradually go to as well, that I haven't seen them.
Some of them do get a bit more complicated. But, I mean, this one, you know, again, if you're giving an instruction to transfer somewhere data somewhere else, and again, we've got to recognize that we're not expecting our processor to do that work. We're expecting the controller to do that due diligence work and get the lawful mechanisms in place. That's the third scenario. We're not going to get through all these, are we? So happy to kind of do a few and then chat about something
else. So Chris has asked in relation to that scenario, what if the UK controller owns the Mexican processor and supplies all of its equipment?
Well, I think we'd have to look at whether it's a wholly owned entity, if it's part of the same entity, or is it a separate legal entity? I have to think that one through.
I think it's the same.
I think
it
was the same, is it? Yeah.
Yeah. If it was a branch of, I mean, if it was let's say it's part of the same organisation, but acting as a process like the HR department doing the payroll for the group, then if it's part of the same entity, the ICA would say it's not an international transfer, wouldn't they?
Mm-hmm.
So I think, again, you'd probably be down to ownership and stuff like that, probably. You'd I'd have to draw that out, to be honest. And
the devil's in the detail, eh, Phil, as always?
The devil's in the flowchart.
The devil's in the flowchart, yeah. I'll just put this whole thing up here. So the
David international wants to speak.
Oh, good.
No. All I was going to say in that last example, you're missing the point. It's who's responsible for the relationship. So in the other one, what the ICO was saying, I don't necessarily agree, but it's what the ICO was saying in this case. It'd be slightly different, I think, for European transfers from a European controller. But they're saying that you're not responsible for the transfer because it's your processor, the UK processor is controlling the Mexican sub-processor, so they're responsible for doing it. In the wholly owned example you've given, they would be responsible because they own they own it anyway. Yeah, you sort of, there is still a transfer that needs documenting. In this example, it's who owns the documenting of that transfer almost. In the first example, because they're two separate entities, two different companies, then what they're essentially saying is you know, if you're doing your first transfer with the UK processor, then you're okay, because it's they have to make sure, and because they're bound by UK law as well, that they do the correct onward documentation for the transfer to the Mexican processor.
Yeah.
Your sub-argument, if it's the same company, well, if it's the same company, then they're responsible. There's still, you've got to document the transfer. It is a transfer. You'd have to document it. And in that example, you are the controller anyway. So you'd be doing a controller processor. Or you'd have to ensure that your UK entity had documented its process, you know, its transfer to the Mexican entity. So I think in all cases, you've got to document what you're doing. I think the difference is that entirely you, which is the first example, is it's not, you've splitting it between two companies. If you started talking about intercompany, well, then you've absolutely got to document it, because you're the controller and the processor, you're everything for that. So I think that's sort of, you got a bit carried away in your last argument, that you'd still have to document it, because in that example, you know, you're responsible for the documentation as well. It isn't a not, there isn't no transfer. There's clearly a transfer. So you'd have had to step through it.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, thank you for that. I think it makes sense, I guess, because even if it's the same entity, it's acting as a processor. Is that what you're saying there? Because it's actually
you'd have to have a legal basis to move that data, so you'd have to document it either as the, you know, but you're the processor in that case if you're the wholly owned, or you'd have to make sure that your subsidiary had documented it correctly, but it'd still be you in that case to make
sure.
But
if you had like a Mexican office of a UK company, I'm pretty sure the ICO says that's not a restricted transfer, because it's the same legal entity. Now, if that office was acting as a...
Not my understanding, but okay. Interesting one. Because I wouldn't see how can you get a Mexican... I mean, how can you get a UK legal entity in Mexico? You can have a subdivision of a UK company, but that's why we put in place transfer documentation. So we've got a full set of... standard contractual clauses between every entity to facilitate transferring company. But if your exception held correctly, we wouldn't need any of it, because it's all between the same company. We're all under the only branches of.
We need to find that. I'm absolutely sure, but I am wrong sometimes, you know, as we all are, that the ICO stance, if I don't agree with, I agree with you
entirely.
I was going to
say, Philip, you could be right on the ICO. I spend much more time doing pure Europe stuff, so
right,
ICO maybe, but it seems
so the ICO's, it doesn't make sense, because the ICO, I'm convinced, somebody find it for me, says that if you transfer data to the same entity in a different country, like Mexico or whatever, it's not a restricted transfer. But that's bonkers, because, you know, that entity is bound by Mexican law as well, as, you know, it's in Mexico. And if the police come and knock on the door and raid it, you know, they raid it, don't they? So it's subject to Mexican law, despite being owned by a UK organization. So I don't agree with the ICO stance on it. But, you know, I'm absolutely sure that's what they say on their website.
Is that the difference between two entities, or, you know, say if you've got, for example, staff from a UK company who are going to move to Mexico to work from there, but still, you know, from the UK's office, I suppose.
Well, let's say they do that. You know, again, once they're in Mexico, they're subject to Mexican law, aren't they? So if there's no Mexico's, I don't know much about Mexico, but let's say we're going to North Korea, you know, where you've got known slightly less prevalent human rights, etc., then, you know, if they get arrested and their laptops gets taken off them, that's what happens, isn't it? And your data might be there. So why is that not a restricted transfer? Why you not got to take precautions? You got to take top technical or organizational security measures, but you don't have to put anything in place about the international transfer. Anyway, I mean, this is what this is all about, isn't it? It's about kicking around the
sparking debate,
exactly. That's what I was looking for. Yes.
I'm not sure if I found it. I've just gone on a page, and I don't know if that's what it is. It's about a quarter of the way down of the page of
But I mean, to David's point, the European Data Protection Board do take, in their guidance, they do take a different stance. You know, So if you're in that situation, we're looking over multiple jurisdictions, it could be that the slightly different rules applied, which you need to be aware of, which obviously David is, which is good.
And it's what makes it so mm-hmm. complicated as well, right, though, and it's why, you know, it's important to have these sort of discussions, because, and the law is always slightly a little bit grey, and so is the guidance as well, isn't it? It's often open to interpretation, which makes our lives a little bit harder, but it makes it all the more fun.
Well, the guidance often is often the obvious cases, you know, and often, you know, you think, actually, that's not quite what I'm looking for. You know, that's what we found with the processor stuff, didn't we? That, you know, the processor examples in the guidance are really obvious ones. And there's not much discussion around the edges of that helps us formulate your view, you know, to help you formulate your view for what actually you're looking at. So you have to just... You have to just go through that process, don't you? Formulating view, yeah. This is their fourth scenario. So an international group runs its UK business through a UK retail company, and its staff are employed by its UK services company. It's centralised human resources service provided by a US branch of the UK Retail Limited, the same part of the legal entity. And the UK Services Limited decides to run its human resources service through its US branch of UK Retail Limited. I hope you're following this. It's easier if you can see it on the screen, I think. So what they're saying is, if the contract is between the UK Service Limited and the US branch of UK Retail Limited, there is a restricted transfer. And if the contract is between the UK Services Limited and the UK Retail Limited, it's not a restricted transfer. In that situation, UK Retail Limited still needs to consider how it manages risks to the personal data due to the flow of the data to its US branch. I think that's what we were just talking about just a minute ago, isn't it? And its compliance with other parts of the UK GDPR. But in terms of restricted transfers, you know, this is again the ICO example, mm-hmm. You know, showing that in some cases restricted transfer, in other cases not restricted transfer. That one fairly obvious and straightforward. Yeah. Right. Sorry, Phil, I was reading the chat. I'm going to do one more, and then we're going to stop doing these. I'm not sure that they're okay. that useful, but this is, I think, the last one to talk through. I think it's quite obvious, you know, personal data transferred from a UK controller routed through a different country to a different UK controller, but you know, there's no restricted transfer because it's just simply a routing issue rather than, you know, what they're saying is a transfer. Which I think everyone probably aware of, aren't they? So if it goes through servers in other countries, not restricted transfer. Right. Anyway, enough of these scenarios. What else did we want to talk about today in terms of international transfers? Anything else we want to go through?
Mena in the chat has said that they're useful and to continue.
Oh, all right.
That's the CIPP revision.
Right. Hang on a sec. Apologies. You may be hasty there. Right, just share my screen.
Go on. I was thinking just for me, it's hard because I have a case where he's a company that is based in the UK, but he's a big company. So we have so many relationships with processors, and then the actual processor have another relationship with sub-processors. And I was thinking as a controller, I understand that in terms of responsibilities, if, for example, the processors are based also in the UK, so they will not have the responsibility in terms of transfers to make these additional safeguards. But are you expecting as a controller to ask something from the processor to all the sub-processors that probably will have additional sub-processors? So I'm just thinking about the big companies that where there are so many relationships across so many partners and parties involved in this. So I'm just thinking about the responsibilities as a controller and what is expected from you, because obviously you can have no responsibility in terms of international transfers, but you still have responsibilities under the UK GDPR to make sure in terms of the relationship as a whole. So I don't know. I just sometimes when I'm talking about big companies, I just came across with all this very confusing and kind of difficult sometimes to understand all the MAPA flow and relationships involved.
just run through that one again. Very, so controller to processors and then down the chain sub-processors.
Yes, and then we continue and hold the relationship. So I understand probably when we controller, we are doing our due diligence and to the processors, this will all rise. Okay. So will you, for example, in the instance of, okay, so the processor will transfer data to this other sub-processors. Are you expecting to see, for example, the actual safeguards implemented and the sub-processing agreement, because probably it will be in these agreements? I don't know. So what will be your responsibilities in this scenario?
I think what your responsibilities are and what you do in practice are probably two different things. I think in practice, you know, you might want to see that there is a process agreement, you know, for every step down the chain, and you might want to see what the legal mechanism is for the transfer, to transfer down the chain. But again, I stand to be corrected, but I think that legally you're required to just get that first step done, unless your instructions are, as we said in one of these scenarios, to transfer data to a processor. But if your processor says, well, we want to subcontract out to a sub-processor down the chain in a different country, I'm pretty sure the GDPR says it's their responsibility to make sure that's covered off. They might have to ask permission, and you might, as part of that due diligence, say, ah, hang on, you know, that's okay. Or not, because you have a right to say no, don't you, as a controller. But I think, again, I think the ICO is clear in saying it's not your responsibility to make sure this mechanism is in place. Again, I don't know, you know, if it came push to shove and it came to court, you know, what would happen, you know?
Yeah, I do wonder, you know, how often it happens where a processor would inform a controller of, you know, any new sub-processors it uses anyway, I think.
But it happened with Salesforce.
It happens a lot. We get them every quarter. We get a list of sub-processors from Salesforce. And if there's a change of process, you get that list. You have the right to object. And they say, well, you have to leave the platform if you object, because we use it anyway. And I've had it from other companies as well. So, you know, those that are, you know, well-organized, I would say, you know, no disrespect to anybody, you know, do it. You know, they say, yes, we know who's in the chain. And I think they possibly use that as a, you know, to their commercial advantage.
It's funny, isn't it? You know, there's these mechanisms in place, like the right to object. But for large organisations where, say, for example, with us with Salesforce, it's so pivotal to our operations that we don't really have a choice.
You don't, yeah. They have,
and that's
with the larger organisations.
And that's probably why the ICO has its kind of view that it's the processor who's responsible for the sub-processor, because there'll be more instances than not that the data controller's kind of left with no choice but to kind of accept what's been put in place.
Well, only with big tech, you know. This scenario on the screen now is interesting, because it's handwritten notes. Again, you know, one might think, well, handwritten notes aren't caught by the GDPR unless part of the structured filing system, but you know, because they're being computerized, then you know they do get caught, and therefore this is a restricted transfer. Interesting one.
So a UK insurance broker sends a set of notes about customers to a company outside the UK. These notes are handwritten and not stored, and are not stored on the computer. I think this is handwritten, or in any particular order. The non-UK company adds the notes to a computer customer management system. So this is restricted transfer. Sorry,
that's quite interesting.
Well,
the other lines that's put me off a bit.
Yeah, that's quite an interesting one, actually. The sending of the notes, it's not caught at that point, though, is it? It's not caught until it's then put onto a computer system. Mm. So no, it's already left the UK at that point, no?
I think it is caught, because I think that I can't remember
it's
the definition.
It's intended to be. Okay. Thanks. Yeah. Well, it's 29 good. Minutes past.
This is time for one more.
Maybe, I don't know. I'll see what it says. Scenario 7: a UK business enters into an IT support contract with an Indian company. The data remains on the UK business's servers in the UK, but is accessed by the IT support team located in India. Again, we come across this quite a lot, don't we? This scenario. Access to the data by the Indian company is a restricted transfer. Because they're doing the processing in India, despite the data remaining in the UK. Got another time, another one as well. Look at scenario 8. On a roll now. A UK company uses a centralized human resource service in the US provided by its US parent company. parent company. The UK company passes information about its employees to its US parent company in connection with the HR service. So a UK company uses a centralised human resource service in the US provided by a US parent company. Mm. The UK company passes information about its employees to its US parent company in connection with the HR service. This is a restricted transfer.
Yeah, just going back on that one. The UK company passes information about... Oh, right, okay. I didn't know...
The US, because about, yeah.
The, if it was like US data subjects, just which way that transfer... you know, that transfer was occurring. I suppose it'd, you know, be both ways, but it seems to be about UK data subjects.
Yeah, going to US and US parent company, therefore not the same company, but, you know, owner of their company. So distinctly separate legal entity.
Well, we should probably call it there. We've still had two scenarios, so maybe a part three.
No.
I'm joking.
No. Sorry.
We hope you enjoyed this session anyway. You know, I think it was a little bit unstructured until we got to the scenarios, but I think we discussed, you know, the complexities of international transfers.
I think it fell apart.
One way or another. Thanks for sticking with us. We'll be back next week for a session on GDPR radio. So we will see you next week. And in the meantime, have a great weekend.
Cheers, guys. See
you
later.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye.
Thanks. Bye.